I know that when the roof ends, I need to swing my mobile sharp left, a heading of 300 degrees to be precise. According to the compass, that's smack center of my steering wheel. That way, the mobile will land on the roof of another building, one that is covered in only about an inch of water thanks to the low tide. Normally, that building would be entirely underwater. And I know none of the other racers will go for this route. They don't watch the tides like I do. That, and I'll make an educated guess here, is why they always lose. Of course, all that planning would be wonderful if it were still the plan. At least the quad isn't too far out of the way of my original route. I don't have time to deviate too far just yet, so I'm still going to run the roof at 300 degrees for the time being. A voice cuts through a wash of static on my headset.
Ren, how you doing?
It's Benny, watching from the roof dock, probably grumbling more than I am about Kent's little stunt. I'm fine, B. Kent's just trying to get me shaken in my boots. My Hessians have never seen me shake, and they're not likely to.
Mama's boy. I should have put maple syrup in his tank when he wasn't looking.
I don't reply. Too much else on the brain. But I chuckle as I imagine Kent trying to start up his mobile and finding it better suited to a hot cake breakfast than to a ward roof race. Here it comes. The end of the building. Readying myself for the jump, I grip the steering wheel. My knuckles whiten. I watch as blackness eats its way toward me until the nose of my mobile dips into the dark mouth. This is, oddly, when my queasiness disappears. When there's nothing, but nothing. Shooting off the edge of the building, now halfway in midair, I hit a red button. My favorite button of all. Rockin'. Music shoots out the stereo. Bass vibrations from an old pre-washout classic. Mostly muffled, but loud enough to keep a girl's head on straight. I'm sure even the people watching from the first roof can hear something. Yes. This is what it's all about. Being airborne is nothing short of bliss. Nothing to worry about. I can't drive, and I can't die. A moment of pure painlessness. Headbanging along with the music, I yell the lyrics. I'm on a highway to hell! And then close my eyes as the mobile drops, probably 10 stories. My stomach can tell. It's used to it. When I first started racing, it would rise into my throat like I was gonna upchuck. Nowadays, this feeling of weightlessness, even for only a moment, is addictive. My stomach plays along. I open my eyes. 3 years of racing have developed my sense for things like how long the 15-story drop should take. I can tell I'm nearing the next roof when I catch a glimpse of the other racers out of the corner of my eye. I was right about Terrence. Sort of. He's driving down the building. All wall racing mobiles have propellers on the front to slow down the momentum for a vertical drive like that. He must have slowed to a crawl before the first roof jump. Both safer and dumber, if you ask me. Safer, as he's not going to nosedive into some unknown building underwater. Dumber, as he's dragging way behind. All in the name of caution. He reaches where the water meets the building, and his mobile slips into the channels. He's going to have his own obstacle course, though. Underwater rubble and wreckage from before the washout. Hundreds of buildings that you can't see from the air. An entire city, even larger than this one, tucked out of sight. A watery ghost town. Nearly impossible to map, too. I'm beginning to think I don't envy his snazzy, water-adaptable carrot. My mobile hits roof too, and is immediately cushioned, too much by the water pooling there. Everything starts to drag and slow, my wheels fighting against the pressure. I do not have the time to frickin' dog paddle through this muck. I must not have measured properly. The water is too deep to keep my wheels down. Though the mobile has already slowed considerably, it's not too late to reach for retract. I do. And all three wheels tuck into the body. The flat underside skips against the waterlogged roof, and I step on the acceleration. Having a limited supply in my H2O tank makes this a bit dangerous to do so early in the race, but I have no choice. Propulsion shoots my Rimbo forward, Within moments, I'm back to an acceptable speed. It's a blur, speeding toward the roof's edge, straight for the canal. My Rimbo makes the terrain shift, skipping along river just fine, but I see I'm using more saline water than I'd expected. I'll have to increase the temperature of the boiler to make it. I need to find roof 3, and if my sense of direction is good, which it is, roof 4 will be the one that gets me into quad 9. Now comes the tricky part. I need to gauge my skips just right. On the last skip before reaching the next building, I'll hit the release button. The wheels will extend out, and then I'll lean away from the wall to get my mobile on its side, and just like that, we'll be driving along the wall of the third building.
Ren. Come in, Ren.
I'd completely forgotten. Benny, hey, all's well. I'm eating up my supply fast, though. A quick peek at the reader tells me that I've got about half a tank left. The comm is quiet. Then Benzie's voice returns through the static.
Well, Plan B is always there if you need it,
he replies. If I have to use Plan B now, there's no way I'm making it to Quad 9, and I can forget about the win. It's time. Last skip. I put all my weight into my left side, trying to raise the right, then release. Sparks fly. The wheels extend just a moment too late. The mobile swings sideways to drive along the building's exterior, her suspension causing a load of jostle. About 20 feet ahead, Kent comes barreling down the wall. Damn! Must have lost more time than I thought back on roof 2. B, come in! I swallow my breath. He's not going to be happy about this. There's been a change in plans. Static rolls through the headset. There's a pause that's just as disturbing as a scream or a cuss.
Ren, what kind of stunt are you thinking of pulling?
He asks slowly. Think quick. He needs to believe that I'm doing this for myself. Why would I be going to Quad 9? A stupid bet I made with Kent. Don't worry about it. His voice rises.
You're going to toss this because of a bet with that...
I cut him off before he gets too riled up. I need a position on our potential 4, but headed toward Quad 9. My guess, I'll need a heading of about 30, though I scout ahead of time so I know the area pretty well. It's easy to lose your sense of direction when you're driving at a 90-degree angle. The crackle of the radio comm screeches in my ear, then Benson's voice returns.
You've got a few options, but none of them will get you first to the finish.
He's pissed, clearly, but not as pissed as he would be if he knew why I was really doing this. So I guess that's a win. Just give me the heading, Benny. Before he can answer, Kent jerks his car in a zigzag to keep me from getting ahead of him. If I can't gather enough speed before the edge of the building, I'm not going to make the jump to the next roof, and it won't matter where it is. The pit of my stomach starts to do a jig, and not in a good way. Like that time I first raced Kent and tore him up. The mic is silent. After what feels like hours, B gives me my move.
If you're aiming for Quad 9, the next roof is far. A heading of 40 degrees northeast.
Close to 30 degrees? Glad I asked. Benson adds,
the race isn't the only thing you lose headed in that direction. Kent won't follow you. Too far, of course. He's not going to go for it. It's a long shot for you, too, but you're bent on a suicide mission. So enjoy.
The mic goes quiet again. I know he resents me right now, but all I can do is move forward with the plan. A bright red light on the dash catches my attention. It's the water tank reader, and it's nearly empty. How is that possible? Just a moment ago, I was at half tank. That should have taken me to building 5 or 6 at least. Benson, my tank is flashing a bloody red E in my face. What do you make of it?
You sure?
His reply is quick, confused. I sigh, rolling my eyes even though he's not here to see me. Yes, Benz, I'm sure. I'm not blind, am I? I can see it flashing clear as day.
Well, you know what to do.
He sounds resigned.
Be it is.
My knuckles are pressed hard, cramping against the steering wheel. How is this happening? No way, I respond, jaw clenched. I can't lose both the race and the surveillance money. I need to make it to the next roof.
And what are you going to do when you get there?
Benny growls. I can hear his anger loud and clear.
Sit down and have a tea party?
He does have a point. I'll just have to make it to Quad 9. After that, I'll have more options. You can find a route via the canals, right? I can see it now. Benny, hunched over his handmade topographical maps of the modern New York City. Contour lines mark the varying heights of the buildings that survived the washout, so he can tell me at a glance whether or not I can make the next building from this one's highest point. As much as we plan, we improvise, too. A flashing red E is textbook. Improvise. He hasn't responded yet. I'm not waiting any longer to make a decision. I'm doing it. Whether or not...
Yes. Yes, you have more options after that.
Static.
If you make it that far.
I will. I just love the vote of confidence. Heartwarming, really. Up front, Kent is still playing around, trying to keep me from getting up to the speed I need in order to cross to the next building. Benson, confirm. It needs to be a roof jump? How high is the next one? I'm running out of time. The edge of the wall must be coming up.
Ren, you can make it from your side of the wall, but you're going to have to cut a hard right, like I said, a heading of at least 40 degrees.
Optimal speed?
119.
He can't be serious. Why didn't you say that in the first place? I yell with no small amount of wrath into the comm. My speedometer reads 95. Peanuts. If only Kent would get the hell out of my way. What is he doing, anyway? How can he afford to just fiddle around with me like this? He's got to have a plan of his own. Or maybe he doesn't care who wins, so long as it ain't me. I jam on the acceleration. I'll just have to make him move. My mobile zips forward and clips his bumper. Kent veers right. He starts crossing the wall diagonally, heading back up toward the roof. Good riddance. 102. I've never taken her past 115. My only fear right now is that she just might not have it in her.
Faster, come on, faster!
My foot is now pressed against the floor. 109. The red light on the dashboard is still flashing like a Christmas tree, but I've got bigger worries right now, believe it or not. 112. The steady acceleration draws my back into my seat, making it near impossible to move. I'm almost there. The edge of the wall is within visibility. I add some of the boiler propulsion, and it gets me to 116. Retract. Hopefully, the wheels tucked in will make my Rimbo more aerodynamic. I hurtle over the edge, but I'm still at 116. I would try to use the props to give me the edge, but by the time they start up, I'd have to turn them off again. There's no way. No more options. If I make the jump at this speed, I'll squash myself into that building like a juicy bug. Instead, I drive straight. My mobile hurtles off the building, and I don't have to look down to know that the Hudson channels are flowing beneath me, capped with ice, jagged and painful-looking. Whatever. Hello, Quad 9. I might have missed Building 4, but maybe I can still survey the area and get my earnings. My mobile holds steady for a good while, then starts to plummet into the channels. Good thing I have a plan B. With a bit more propulsion at precisely the right moment, I can water skip and refill the tanks, thanks to Benny's clever suction thingamajigger. All it does is suck up the brackish water already in the channels and redeposit it into my tank. Filling my lungs with much-needed air, I'd been holding my breath. I ignore the possibility of imminent doom. This is what life is all about, right? As the mobile drops toward the channels, I try and keep it as straight as possible. Just before it collides with the smooth surface, I turn on the back prop, setting my mobile skipping like a schoolgirl. Strange, though, considering how low my tank is, I'm surprised the prop even works. Heck, if it ain't broke, who am I to complain about some good old-fashioned luck? I need to fill up the tank, fast. On the far right are two more buttons, side by side. The first just has a picture on it, a zero with a backslash through it. The second reads suction. Benny told me what to do when he installed this bit, but now I'm drawing a blank. I hit the symbol and wait. If I thought the dashboard looked like Christmas before, it's like Christmas on steroids now. Distracted by the blinking reds and greens, I swerve to avoid a spire reaching out of the channel like one of the Derby's girlfriend's stilettos. I clip the spire on my left side, sending my mobile sideways. Out the window, I can hardly believe what I see, a steady stream of water flowing out the tubes. Frantic, I press the suction button. It's too late. The tank's entirely empty, and from my Rimbo's erratic jostle, I'd say Mama Deathspire took out my front prop. Gauging from the motion and weight of the mobile, I have about 6 more skips before... Brack. More underwater rubble, and it's knocked the rear of my mobile up into the air. Instead of sinking, nice and easy, it's going to be a nosedive. Perfect. How am I going to get myself out of this one? For the first time, I feel it. I'm used to turning my nerves to metal, but now they're molten and liquid, every cell buzzing, fiery. Fear isn't just a feeling in your head. It swallows you whole. Racing is dangerous, I know. I've always known it. But the when, the real end, that's been unknown. And in case it was ever in question, I'm well aware of my immortality complex. Orphanage psyche valves were good for something. I mean, I've never lost a race, or broken a bone. And I can never get the blight. Of course I act like I'm immortal. But with my options dwindling faster than the water in my tank, I remember I ain't made of metal. And if I do make it, not only do I lose the win, but there's no way that I'll be able to survey Quad 9, so I'll lose that money too. Avon can't afford my losing. Nights of hearing her howl from headaches caused by the tumor. Me knowing it's my fault she's hurting. It'll be too much for us. My Rimbo's nose slices into the water. Against the window, a great splash crashes. I remember too late that I should have tried to open it before going under. Will the glass hold? Maybe I should have had it replaced. Maybe it really is too old. Right. I remind myself, like I could have seen this coming. Any moment now, I bet it will crack directly over my head, bust open, sending a dozen pointy daggers down on me. For the briefest instant, the tail nods against the surface, readying itself to sink. Then the nose and front wheel suck slowly underwater. My Rimbo ain't airtight, and so, within moments, water begins to flow through the unsealed spaces. I tug at the moonroof, trying to slide it open, but the water's weight is too heavy. Nothing budges. My Hessians feel the leak first. Poor things. And then my toes feel cold and wet. The water is rising. Chapter 4. 1:40 a.m., Saturday. I'm pounding against the glass, now wishing it would crack. Water splashes inside the mobile all around me. Grimy, icy slush finds my mouth. I close my eyes, struggling to get out through the moonroof, pushing against it. My Rimbo drops into the sunken city. I open my eyes despite the cold and the water. Beyond the roof, giant-sized buildings loom, towers of brick with the windows crashed in. I can't stop looking. I can't stop trying. It takes less than a minute for the water to reach my neck. Despite it all, I'm thankful for my leather jumpsuit. It's keeping me warm. Relatively speaking, that is. I press my mouth against the glass and take a deep breath, one that I hope will last me long enough. As the water starts clinging to the ends of my hair, moves to soak the roots and all of my scalp, Avon appears in my mind. Like a punch to the gut. A sister who is not my sister. As close a resemblance to each other as a swan has to a pigeon. And I'm the pigeon. Take everything about me, flip it on its head to get its opposite. That's Avon. She's too good. For me. For the world. Why did she pick me? Of all the people in Nail's orphanage, she picked me. Did she think I could protect her? Selfish? Reckless, I didn't even want her around to start. Panic starts ticking away in my chest until I can actually feel my heart bombing around in my ribcage. What have I done? Losing the money would have been bad. But was it really worse than her losing me? Without thinking, I open my mouth just a little bit. A trickle of water flows in. Fear is in my mouth, too, with an aftertaste like acid. The thing I can't leave. It isn't life. It's Avon. The inside of the mobile is now filled. I tug again at the roof. It doesn't budge. The pressure inside should have equalized against the outside right about now. My arms move too slow. I slog through the water, my hand fumbling for the knife I keep strapped inside my boot. Above, the watery ceiling has turned so dark, and I can't tell how far I've sunk. Has this taken seconds? Minutes? I can't tell. My mind is all dizzied. I can't panic. I won't panic. Using what energy I've got left, I spear the tip of my knife into the glass window. Nothing. I pound again on the window, trying to weaken the spot. Still nothing. But I think I see a slight webbing. The blades cracked the window, barely. Hoping the third time really is the charm, I go full force. I hurdle myself and the knife into the window. It works. The glass cracks, breaks into pebbles. They float toward my face. I shield myself and shimmy through the side window, avoiding the fragments jutting from the frame. Out in the open channel, my body feels weightless, drifting. Next to me, my Rimbo slams into a building, loosening some of the bricks. Debris barrages down, a slow-motion shower of stone and concrete pieces. I can't avoid them all. All I can do is dodge them, one by one. Dog paddle. Push myself backward. Then, somewhere along my forehead, sharpness and fire are all I feel. A bloom of red appears before my eyes. A square shape bashes into my shoulder. Eyelids grow heavy. I can't make myself want to stay awake. The swirling underwater city fades into jagged shapes and shades of brown. Navy, too. It's as if the sky is somehow underwater, and I'm sinking into a galaxy of black. Air hunger forces my eyes open. My body heaves, convulses. I ignore the need to open my mouth. How long was I out? It don't matter. Instinct overrides thought. My body knows what to do, even if exhaustion has made my brain useless. I swim. Up. Can't get there fast enough. Arms grow heavier. I can barely feel my legs. Though my Hessians are still on, I think. Thank goodness. Then I can't help it. I open my mouth. Water rushes in, salty and cold. So cold it makes my teeth ache. It trickles down my throat, knifing my lungs. I gag. I push myself up. It feels like hours since I came to. Years since I went under. Years till I reached the surface. Avon. The race. The money. My Rimbo. All of it pulls me back to myself like the riptide of a tsunami. I need to get out of the water. Each stroke tears at my muscles. Something as light as water has never felt heavier to anyone, anywhere. It's lead. My body is lead. It's like lead pushing lead, and I can't even be sure I'm moving. Am I moving? Then, a slow shift in darkness, from the black of a raisin to the black of sun-bleached asphalt. I believe it only when my hands shoot out of the frigid water, next my elbows, then forehead, my nose, my mouth, choking and retching is last. Hard and fast, I suck the sharp air into my lungs. It stings. Heady with relief, I close my eyes. My body is so tired, though, it forgets to tread water. Again, I go under. Stupid! I push myself up, once, twice. Swim! I'm numb to the cold now, but my brain knows enough to tell my arms to paddle and my legs to kick. Once more, I force my head above the surface. Beside me, the brick siding of a wall, and not too far off, an escape ladder. I swim, flail more like it, through the dark canal, inching my way closer to the ladder. When I reach it, I throw myself out of the water, trying to catch the bottom rung so that I can pull it down. I catch it in my grip, and the ladder collapses down. Chips of white paint and rust flake off. Ignoring the ladder's shake, I pull myself up. Never did like those chin-ups they made me do during DI training, but now I'm grateful. A few rungs later, and I'm level with the huge window, cracked open wide and covered with algae. It tinges the sharp edges with green, makes them look smooth. Finally, I'm close enough to the windowsill that I can swing myself half in the building, half out of it. Glass crunches under my fingers. I can hear it. The only reason why it registers on my radar, not because I can feel anything. Well, there's one perk to being nearly paralyzed from cold, I guess. Shards rip the leather at my thigh. Skin, too, possibly, though I can't feel it. Both feet touch ground at last. I collapse onto the floor, grasping for flimsy, disoriented threads of thought. My blood pools on a mildewed carpet, and my teeth dance around in my mouth. I clench my jaw to still them. One look at my hand shows me they're shredded from the windowsill and have turned a delightful shade of blue. I imagine my lips are about the same. A heavy panting, my heavy panting, brings me to myself. I wipe my face of the brack water, and my hand comes back red. Only then do I notice the deep sting of a gash somewhere around my temple. I flex my hands, watching the red squeeze from each cut. I may as well be a robot, nerve-free. Don't feel a thing. On my wrist, my cuffcom blinks a fluorescent red through a cracked screen. This one is water-resistant, but the crack must have allowed some in. Still, it's a reminder that so long as I've got a heartbeat, I've got a job. I feel for my video comm, though it wouldn't do me any good with my cuffcom not working. It's gone anyway. Must have lost it in the crash. Benny will be able to approximate my location from the GPS in my Rimbo, though, so he'll send someone for me. I'm sure of it. Which means I don't have much time. I may have lost the race, but I can still scout for that Justin guy. At that thought, a wave of adrenaline courses through, makes me forget for a moment how broken I am. I try to stand, but my legs wobble, and I lose my balance. Then I feel myself shaking from the bottom up. This irritates me. I've got to scout before anyone gets here, but my thermal homeostasis has just been given an icy cold middle finger, and I need to get warm. That's step one. I force my Hessians to carry me around the perimeter. Until I can arrange heat, movement is key. Get the blood pumping. I pass old bulletin boards, whiteboards, and wooden chairs, too, scattered along the floor. Peeling paint and tiny scampering critters tell me that this place has been deserted since the washout. With each step, the floor creaks. Hope this building doesn't collapse with me in it. They can go under so easily, and my Rimbo hit the thing real good. Feeling for my utility belt, I remember the lighter and my flashlight. It turns freshwater neon, but I can still use it. I pull the lighter out of my belt, removing it from some elastic lining that seems waterproof. Don't know for sure, as I've never needed to look. To get the lighter started, I roll my finger over the metal. Nothing but sparks. With a few more flicks, I have a flame. A small one, sure, but it will do. My utility belt has already proven handy, and I say a secret thanks to Benny for making me wear it all these years. For your protection, he'd say, and I'd take the belt and hook it on to humor him. Never thought I'd actually need any of this junk, aside from the flashlight. And even that, well, it's been years since we've found a local freshwater spring in these parts. I never expect I'll need the flashlight. Now for some dry fabric. I start opening all the doors on this level, hoping that one of them is a closet. When I find one with a few coats, I toss a whole pile of musty, moth-eaten fabric to the ground and light the edges on fire. I'm not worried about the building burning down. Everything here is damp from tide fluctuations. After some blowing, the coats go up in flames. I get as close to the growing fire as I can without burning my jumper off, then step out of my hessians to let my feet roast. The blood creeps back to my extremities, and every sensation is magnified, painfully so. It's worse than being numb, I realize. I know it won't last long, that my skin just has to get used to this new and improved, fully functional body temperature, but that don't make it any easier. I give myself 2 minutes, then slide my hessians back onto my feet. They're still wet, and I'd rather go barefoot, but I'm not stupid. I stamp out what's left of the glowing, charred coats with my soles. Grabbing one of the last coats from the closet, I make my way down into the stairwell. If fresh water is going to be anywhere, it'll be either ground level or under the basement. Blue's training and common sense taught me that. It's dark, so I flip on the flashlight, clutching the banister the whole way. I'm in no shape to be doing this. My knees rattle like a madman's, and the cold is creeping under my skin again. But on the upside, that gash on my temple feels like it's clotted. Need to keep moving. The plan is to first find out if the lower levels are underwater. I step out into the 9th floor, officially below the water level. The stairwell isn't flooded, so I'll make an educated guess and say that the lower floors probably aren't as well. The 9th floor looks much the same. But there's one key difference, the windows. Every single window on this floor has been patched up with bricks and mortar. Why would someone do that? If they wanted to preserve the building, why is this place deserted? And why stop just at the water level? It don't make much sense. Back in the stairwell, I pick up my pace. By now, the race is probably over. Someone should be coming for me. Level after level, staircase after staircase, my head starts to spin, and nausea sets in just as I realize I'm going to have to walk back up. I groan out loud. The sound rebounds off the stairwell, a reminder that I'm the only one in here. For some reason, this makes me nervous, as though smashing my mobile into the canal and busting up my face haven't already made me nervous. But the quiet, a deep echoing kind, lets me know how alone I really am. How I could pass out here and never come to, and no one would find me. Just some crazy dragster turning to bone in a rotting stairwell. That's the kind of realization I don't need to be reminded of at every turn. When I finally reach the ground level, well, when I reach what was the ground level before the waters rose, I see signs dangling from the ceiling. They've got letters and numbers on them reading Uptown or Downtown. This was a subway, one of those underground trains people used to get around on. The Blues taught me about subways early on during my scout training. The tunnels continue a ways in the distance, lines of rusted track laid out for miles. If I strain my ears, I can hear droplets of water sounding off, rhythmic, like a busted faucet in the underground. Seeing as I'm 15 stories underwater, there's probably a leak somewhere. I don't want to get my hopes up. Still, I glance around, listen for a direction. Though I don't expect to find anything, at least this way I'll have something to tell Officer Corey. The building is, after all, in Quad 9. He never specified where in the quadrant I needed to look. This flashlight is so genius right now. I flip it on and head right. Random pools of water, brack or rain, I don't know, gather under the tracks. The beam turns them bright, and I follow the drip, drip, dripping way back into the dark. Every few steps, I slow, stop, listen to the droplets and their echo. I continue walking, then I pause. Wait. They're doing more than that. I hear something at the tail end, a final sound, like water trickling into a full-up bucket. The sound of water as it falls into even more water. For a moment, my heart does a jig. It could be, I think, almost allowing myself to hope. I inhale, and I let the steady rhythm of its falling lead the way, like it's calling to me. Speaking. Chapter 5. 2 a.m. Saturday. I keep on moving. The sound is so loud. It must be next to me. But the farther I walk, the farther away it gets. Where'd it go? I backtrack until I can hear it again. But there's nothing in front, and nothing behind. Next to me, maybe? I press my ears to the tunnel walls. Sure enough, I find it. The spot where the sound is loudest. But what am I supposed to do, walk through walls? I shine the beam along the grime-covered tunnel, looking for a crack, a crevice, anything. Then I see it. A hole, made from a different material than the tunnel walls. The hole is, of course, filled in with bricks. Ugh. I'm really starting to hate bricks. First, the knock on the head, now this? I steady my foot and aim to kick the things, when I realize one crucial difference. This time, there is no mortar. These bricks were meant to be removed. And who better to remove them than me? I get down on all fours and start hammering away at them with my flashlight. After each swing, it shakes on and off like a strobe light. The flashing makes me dizzy, so when I give the final blow that ends its life as a flashlight and turns it into an official hammer, I'm almost happy. Darkness coats the tunnel again. I pull all my air tight between my lungs. Hadn't realized what a comfort the light was. You won't get lost. There's left, there's right, and there's up. The segments loosen, and since I don't want to have to crawl into a pile of bricks, I try to push them to either side of the hole using the flashlight-turned hammer. When I've removed enough of the bricks that I can crawl through the opening, I take my coat off to get rid of some of my bulk. My kneecaps crush into the gravel and whatever else is sharp and pointy underneath me. I slide forward, inch by inch. Without the light, I have no sense of how large the interior is. I whistle. The sound doesn't carry far. It's cramped in here. There's a dripping, and it's coming from a few different sources along the ceiling, but I can't see where. I keep on inching, continuing the crawl. My palms pick up pebbles as I slide along. An ache in my wrists tells me the ground slopes. I put my left hand down. Then my right, then left. A slippery wet against my fingertips, my wrists, all the way to my elbows sink down, and then it's too late. More water. Hot water. And a little bit slimy, too. I'm in it head first, flailing around, splashing and kicking, and trying to right myself. Out of habit, I choke out the stuff, expecting sour, dank, brackish bitterness. Only I find none. This water, it's sweet. I get my head back to where the air is, tonight's theme, still choking from the surprise of it all. It's hot, and it's sweet, with no trace of the saline that's made the local reservoirs undrinkable. I bob around for a few moments, allowing myself to luxuriate. This is about as close as I've gotten to a bubble bath in years. Who cares that it's made of ancient subway mud? As I dog paddle to get a sense of the space, I can tell it's small, not much wider than 7 feet across. I can tell because though the tunnel is mostly dark, a tiny orb of light is glowing neon just a few feet below the surface. My flashlight. It's shining like new, clinging to a ledge. Great. Now it works. I reach for it, and then realize it's glowing. Not just glowing. Neon purple. The thing is glowing neon purple. I don't believe it. I dive down, thanking the subway gods for the warmth of the water. I don't think I could have taken any more cold. Keeping my eyes open till I have the light in my hand, I find myself wincing out of habit, expecting salt water to burn my eyes. But no, nothing. Soon as I have the flashlight back in my hand, the fact of what I have literally fallen into hits me. A hot spring would have been bizarre enough, though there is a fault line around these parts somewhere. But that's not all. Fresh water. I never really believed I'd find it. Hoped. Sure. In in a probably not going to happen sort of way. Do I even remember the procedure for what to do after finding it? Wait. Yes, I do. My flashlight. I'd totally forgotten. That's where the test tube is stored. And I used the thing as a hammer. Brack! How could you have forgotten? Hey, head trauma, I remind myself. If ever I deserved a little slack, it would be now. I unscrew the back of the light. A cork falls out, followed by teensy glass pieces. Wonderful. To the canteen, then. Removing the cap, I dunk the bottle into the spring. Once it's filled to the brim, I almost can't help myself. I have to taste it. I shouldn't. Who knows what's in the stuff? But I've already swallowed gulpfuls, thanks to falling in. If I'm going to get sick, the damage has already been done. I bring the canteen to my lips, pull it away before it touches. Then, I drink. The fresh tastes so much better, cleaner, purer than the rainwater from the dinky drainage systems everyone in the ward has. One gulp follows another. I didn't realize how thirsty I was. I chug until my stomach feels jiggly as a water balloon, and when I'm done, I refill the canteen for boss. A slight nausea sets in, and I want nothing more than firm ground beneath me. So I swim around the edge of the spring, digging my fingers into the slippery, sponge-like surface around the pool's edge. I steady myself, and with one push, pull myself from the pool. Still heady with the taste of the spring water on my tongue, I begin the awkward, plodding wriggle back through the crawl space into the tunnel. Exhaustion has begun to settle in. Thank goodness for these walls. They keep me balanced, but I have to remember to lift my feet or I'll trip on the rails. And then, a tingling sensation starts behind my eyeballs. Not uncomfortable, at first. The tingle soon becomes a prickle, which in turn becomes a burn. My eyes water. Salt tears coat my cheeks. The cuts, all of which have started to sting. But it's worse than that. Across my entire face, the scrapes and the fresh cuts also begin to burn. Like a bonfire, the fire grows, and it grows, and soon enough the fire starts to itch, and hell do I want to scratch. I don't know what's going on. My lips, my forehead. If I had nails, I'd be raking them over my skin right now. I'm about to rub at my cheeks, but then my hands, my arms, every microscopic cell in my body also feels like they've been doused in gasoline, then lit on fire. I think I hear myself calling out to the stairwell, but I know I'm alone. Lit on fire. And here I am, 15 stories underwater, but with no way to quit the burn. Chapter 6. 2:20 a.m., Saturday. I'm calling into the stairwell, or I'm hearing a noise from the stairwell. I don't even know. The scratching. I'm doused. I'm hallucinating. I must be hallucinating. None of it was real. The hot spring, the fresh water, that's the only thing that makes sense. If none of it makes sense. But in the stairwell, a noise. Am I making it up? I speak out, voice hoarse and quaking, just in case. Hello? The word comes out too weak for even me to hear. Again. Hello? I yell, louder this time. I'm draining my energy, shrieking like this. But I don't care about that either. If someone is there, I want them to hear me loud and clear. I open my eyes, but everything's blurry through the tears. Boots. Thunk, thunk. Thunk, thunk. Two at a time, then silence. A scraping, the squeak of palms gripping a wooden banister. It's gotta be Terrence. Benny would have told him where my Rimbo crashed, and Terrence got that Omni now. The thunking noise closes in. Stay right there, Ren. I'm coming for you. That voice. I know that voice. It's not Terrence's. Please don't let it be him. Please don't let it be him. I whisper to myself, Derek can't see me like this. But here he comes, finally in my line of sight, his coppery head of hair bright and glinting. even in the dark of the stairwell. Or maybe it's not that it's so bright. Maybe it's just that I'd know him even if I were blind, which isn't too far from the truth right now. I can barely open my eyes. The feverish feeling is gone, but not the itch.
Derek,
I mumble. My bookie, the only guy who makes me forget my words with no more than a look. He hurtles down the stairs, trousers slick, white-collared shirt soaked and hugging his skin. He must have swum from the mobile to get into the building. The thought makes me warm. Then he leans over me, lacing his fingers behind my back and knees. That's when I get really hot. I'm about to resist. I can still walk. I have legs after all. But he lifts me up so easily, as though I weigh no more than a small bird. And I may be small, but I'm not light.
How on earth did you get all the way down here?
He asks, almost to himself, voice muffled. When I start to answer, he tells me,
shh, it's okay. Save your energy.
His breath on my face. It burns my cheeks, already scalding. I'm closer to his skin than I've ever been. Millimeters between us. I could press my nose to his tattoo, a small, graying circle symbol just under his earlobe that I've always known was there, but I've never been close enough to get a look at. I could touch my lips to it if I wanted, nip at it the way the orphanage cat used to give Avon and me love bites. I must be delirious. I see all his tiny, almost invisible freckles, too. Dozens that I never knew he had, dotting his cheeks and nose and jaw. I want to say something. I have freckles, too. But, like always, my thoughts are mealy mush when I'm around him. Avoiding his eyes is the only way I can keep my head straight with him near. I turn my gaze to anything else, though there's not much to look at. Some lovely banisters to my right and left. Stairs, too. Those will do. Just not his eyes. For some inexplicable reason, much as I don't want to, I lean into him. My body sinks against his arms and chest. Okay, I tell myself. It's okay. You're tired. You've had a rough day. This is your survival at stake, right? Immediately, my cheeks feel better against the wet of his shirt. The itch fades. He carries me the whole way to the top, his breathing barely labored. Boy's in shape. When we come to the windowsill that I came in through, I push away from him, signaling him to put me down. I'm not going back in the water. Already too wet. Cold. No. Derek takes some more coats from the closet and drapes them over the windowsill. I don't know what he's doing. I watch him straddle the sill, sitting on the coats. My heart's beating like it does before the races, but for an entirely different reason. I'm still wrapped up in his arms. Then, an orange Omni's headlights break through the darkness under the water, setting the channel aglow. If I weren't feeling like absolute crap, I might find it sort of pretty. Terrence steers closer to the window, and Derek swings one leg into the moonroof, steadying the mobile. He does it just like he's mounting a horse, like they do in the pictures I've seen during my history classes back in the orphanage. He sets me atop the roof, careful, straddling himself behind me. My spine curves into his abdomen. I may feel terrible, but I'm not too far gone to take a mental note of his nice, strong muscle. Stop, Ren. This attraction I have is from afar. He can't know I'm into him. He's my bookie. Our relationship is strictly business. He gives me my winnings from the races, we make small talk, and I go. I know he cares about me. He's always warning me of the dangers of racing, something I'm sure he doesn't do with the other racers. And I know it's not because I'm just a girl. I'm always winning. But there's caring, and there's caring. My energy seems to be returning now that Derek's obscenely hot, warm, as in temperature, body presses up behind me. I begin to lower myself into the Omni, but Derek's hands cup under my armpits, dangerously close to other places, and he helps me down. Normally, I'd be chafing at this sort of thing. I'm a girl who can handle her own, but right now, I'm content to play the damsel. And to be honest, I'm not entirely playing. I might even blush. And I wouldn't be playing at that either.
Yo, Tear,
I croak, seeing him up front at the wheel.
Thanks for coming to pick me up.
I smile weakly. He looks in the rearview mirror, brows knitted together, clearly anxious.
Who won?
Curiosity always gets the best of me.
You worry about getting warm,
Terrence tells me from the front seat. I grunt. He probably won. Better than Kent or Jones winning, though, I remind myself. I open my mouth to tell him about the spring, but then I remember. It was a scouting mission, and no one, not even Tear, my closest friend, can know I work for the Blues. Besides, the Codes and Violations Handbook states that any findings on a scouting mission must first be reported to the Blues base. Never tell civilians anything. Makes sense, I suppose, not telling civilians. Can't have hordes of people fed up with crappy rainwater drainage systems, draining acid rain at that, flocking to a structurally unsafe abandoned building all at once. Recipe for disaster. I keep my mouth shut, but that giddy feeling about my discovery, combined with Derek's warm, muscled body all pressed up against my side, makes me feel nothing short of bliss. I choose to ignore pain at this particular moment. And then, of course, reality does its thing. My post-race report to the boss. I've never missed a report. I don't even know what the procedure is. Will Chief punish me? A sub-zero fear works its way up my spine. It's okay, I tell myself. It's okay. He must have heard about the accident by now. He'll know I haven't bailed. Still, I can't help the shivers once they start in. Derek rubs his hands together nervously. You should really get out of here. He coughs a little, as if not wanting to finish his sentence. He thinks I'm shivering because I'm cold. Terrence brought a pair of sweats you can change into. I almost gather the energy to full-on belly laugh. Now I'd be lying if I said that the thought of being in a state of undress with Derek hadn't crossed my mind at one point or another. But this is a whole different story. No way. I am not getting naked in a mobile full of boys.
Psh,
you wish. I spit out. I'll stay cold in my shredded, shrunken leather getup, thank you very much. A line of static comes in through Tara's headset. He holds down the green button by the mouthpiece.
Come in?
He releases the button, then looks back.
She with you, Terrence?
Even through the low-grade mic, I can hear Benson's fear.
Sure is,
Terrence replies with a heaving sigh.
You okay, kiddo?
Benny asks. He never calls me kiddo. I race with the big boys, and I get treated accordingly. But the way he says this now, well, he must be feeling especially mushy. Terrence passes the headset to the back seat, and I slip it over my ears, clicking the green button.
Fantastico, B. Just a few scrapes.
I pause, remembering how I have to meet up with Justin.
I'll see you at the tank in an hour,
I say, my hand instinctively moving to the tender gash on my forehead. At least it's not dripping anymore. That was annoying. And painful, obviously.
The tank, Ren?
The line goes silent, and Tear and Derek exchange glances in the rearview mirror. I groan, embarrassed that I forgot. A racer goes down, the after-party gets postponed tonight. A nice bit of respect in a not-so-respectful industry.
Oh, right, I mumble unhappy. I don't like delaying my meeting with Officer Corey. It's a good thing, Ren.
Derek's eyes catch mine, and I glance away. He pulls a scratchy wool blanket from underneath the seat and drapes it over my shoulders and around my waist.
You need rest.
And though it doesn't do much to warm me, I'll admit that it's nice when he starts to rub the blanket over my leather sleeves. Looking up at Terrence and Derek, I'm amazed. It still amazes me. Having people who care? The only missing piece is Avon. For a second, I'm angry she's not with me, even though she's home, barely moving these days, and couldn't make it here if she tried. Still, I nearly died. She's the only person I really want with me right now.
Let's hit your mobile now, too. Will you last that long? I can come back for it if you'd rather,
Terrence asks.
Let's just get her home, Terrence.
Derek responds.
She needs to get warm. I think the worst is over, but still.
No, really, I'm...
Later. He'll come back for it later. He interrupts.
I do not want to leave my Rimbo all crunched and crushed at the bottom of the channels. But I have no choice.
Fine.
I grumble. Whatever, it's clearly not fine. But so long as my Rimbo gets to Benson's garage, I'll be okay. Then he can fix her up, find out what happened to Plan B and why it bunked out on me.
Ter, you know where Ren's place is from here?
Derek asks. My fists ball up instinctively.
No, not like this, Avon,
I cry out. For a moment, they're both quiet, tense. I never talk about Avon, not even to Ter, and he knew her from the start, at Nails. They learned early on not to bring her up unless I did, which I usually don't.
If she sees me like this, she'll be so worried. I have to get cleaned up first. Someplace else. Please.
Terrence nods, but answers sheepishly.
I still live at home with my dad. So unless you want to go to the hospital, which is exactly where my pops will make you go, my place is in Negatory.
I know where this is going. I need to get myself some girlfriends.
Fine, Ter. Take Ren to my place.
Chapter 7. 4:15 a.m. Saturday. All this clean water, and here I am just floating around in it. I've always known Derek was rich. He's my bookie, after all. But this is obscene.
Is this what it will be like for everyone in the ward once the Blues get to piping off that spring?
Thanks to yours truly. I allow myself a bit of brag time in my head, because, hey, I did almost die on that mission of theirs. That's worth something. I laugh to myself, buzzing from tonight's events. The sound echoes like gunfire against the marble bathroom walls. Derek's bathroom walls.
Man, do I love bubbles.
I love bubbles so much that if I could be anything in the whole universe, it would be a bubble. Pre-pop, of course. Post-pop, and they're, well, gone. Bubbles just float around, not a care in the world. Multicolored and clear. Would you believe it? There's this one bubble doing a balancing act on my big toe right now. I dip my fingers in the sudsy bathwater, and sticking my tongue out as I do when aiming really, really hard, I flick my finger, sending a splash its way. But it's a persistent bugger. No, it says. I will not go down without a fight.
It's nice not being dead, you know?
It's especially nice not being dead in Derek's tub. The bathwater starts to feel cool, so I reach for the shiny porcelain handle and add more hot. Indulgent, I know. The water comes streaming from the faucet like pure gold. And all this water! He must have a drainage system the size of Africa. Bet it takes up his entire roof, which means he owns the building. Come to think of it, which building am I even in? Leaning my head against the hammered brass tub, I try to remember the ride back, during which I was completely zombified. Last thing I recall is dozing off on Derek's shoulder. I have no idea where in the ward we are. I do know I was half asleep by the time he set me in the tub. The only way to get my temp up. He must have been fretting about the possibility of my getting hypothermia. Eventually, when I realized I was being lowered into even more water, I awoke. And there Derek was, sitting over me in my birthday suit. So yeah, there I was, naked in front of Derek. Me. Naked. In front of Derek. And I didn't even get to enjoy it. That's when I screamed like a banshee out of hell.
Okay, okay, I just wanted to make sure you didn't drown again.
Out! I said, not bothering to correct him, that I did not, in fact, drown a first time. And out he went. What an effed up night. It's like all my dreams are coming true. Finding fresh water, getting closer to Derek, but in this really messed up way. My mind drifts to other things, like how I'm going to handle Officer Corey, and the logistics of this freshwater discovery. And the fact that I missed my report to Boss Man. I bet he's already messaged my backup cuff comm at home to reschedule. I've never missed a report before. I don't mess around with these guys. Never wanted to give them a reason to cut my pay. We couldn't afford that. I sink my head underwater, eyes open, let the heat flood over, watching a watery mosaic of light and soapy blue. Sound becomes cocoonish, as if the world only exists within a few inches of my skull. I found fresh. I found fresh. Then why does it feel like nothing's changed? Why does it feel like nothing's better? The answer is easy. My sister is still going to die. Whether or not Justin Corey quadruples his offer, whether or not everyone gets their fair share of the spring, whether or not I work for the Blues, or race, or live, or bite it, whether or not anything, she just is. All the fresh in the world can't keep Avon alive. I look at my arm without thinking, to the raised X's there. She has only two. Indoors, the Blues don't test. We talked about bringing her to the hospital, but there's just not enough money. Cheaper to buy the pain meds black market and have the doctor make a house call when we're flush with green from hefty winnings. The last doctor gave her 3 months. I dig my nails into my palms. How dare he give her an expiration date? She's not an effing carton of milk. And when she does expire, I'm back to being alone, just like how I was before I met her. Whatever. She's already a corpse. You're not losing much. I force myself to unclench my fists, hating myself for even thinking that. It's not true. Not always. Though these days she's less and less herself. There's a rock in my throat. If I cried, it would go away. But I can't. Water trickles into my ear canals, replacing the air. The sensation, so small but so distinct. It's too much. I open my mouth and choke back a wrenching gulp, taking